Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. President Trump has put American trade practices under a microscope, at times instituting tariffs on China, Canada, Mexico, and members of the EU. The moves have led to retaliatory measures, which some American businesses, such as manufacturers and farmers, say are hurting them. How is this impacting the economy? What does it mean for you? Economist Hugh Johnson and Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasidi are here for today's discussion and to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number, 1-800-348-2551. Trades, tariffs, Wall Street, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The U.S. and China are locked in a trade dispute, lodging tariffs and economic threats back and forth. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is hopeful the cancellation of metal tariffs against Canada and Mexico will lead to congressional approval of a new North American trade agreement. These economic factors have played with traders in recent weeks, with news sending stocks up and down on Wall Street. Joining us to answer your questions about all of this, Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasidi. Hugh is the chief investment officer and founder of Hugh Johnson Advisors, LLC, in Albany. He is an economic advisor to the chairman of the New York State Assembly Committee on Ways and Means, a professor at Union Clarkson Graduate College, and a former member of the New York Stock Exchange. Aaron Pasidi is an associate professor of economics at Siena College, whose research and teaching focuses on macroeconomics, political economy, labor markets, employment, insecurity, inequality, and economic history. In addition to academic journals, Aaron's research has been featured in the Washington Post and Baltimore Sun and the Huffington Post. He's also a member of WAMC's vaunted roundtable panel. If you have a question for our guest today, the number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Hugh Johnson, Aaron Pasidi, welcome to Vox Pop.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Every day seems to offer a new twist to the trade dispute between the U.S. and China. Today, the Trump administration announced it'll provide $16 billion in aid to farmers hit hardest by this, for lack of a better term, trade war. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue detailed the White House's plans on a conference call with reporters, and we will play some of that audio right now.
Ensure that farmers will not bear the brunt of those trade practices by China or any other nation. While farmers themselves will tell you they'd rather have trade than aid, without the trade that has been possible, then they're going to need some support from a profitability standpoint. We honestly and sincerely know and believe that it is a food security issue, which leads to a national security issue. So our team at USDA reflected on what worked well last year and what we could have done better when we ran last year's program, and most effectively redesign this program to support farmers over the longer term. That being said, frankly, all of this would have been moot if China had acted appropriately and fairly in many of the areas regarding intellectual property theft and non-tariff barriers that they have put up for many years. The U.S.-China economic relationship is very important, and the Trump administration is still committed to reaching a good deal for agriculture and other American industries as whenever China wants to play by the rules of the WTO and the world economy.
And putting aside for just a moment the $16 billion to farmers, and we will talk about that soon. Hugh Johnson, you were on this program several months ago, and this was brewing at the time, this dispute with China. Can you call it a war now?
It's a really a high-level skirmish and one that certainly hasn't been resolved. The lines have been set. The contestants are really battling it out. And both, quite frankly, have very, very good arguments on their side. And that's what, in some ways, makes it compelling. It makes it compelling for the Trump administration. They have good reason to play it tough. I wouldn't look at Trump and say this is the Trump administration as much as I would say it's Robert Lighthizer, who is a hawk on trade and very, first of all, knowledgeable, very much of a hawk, and very tough. And I think that what you're seeing out of Washington is really a tough fight. And quite frankly, that's exactly what I would expect. This just hasn't been resolved. You could ask me, do I think it's going to get resolved? Yeah, I do think it's going to get resolved. Do I think it's going to end up in a trade deal? Yes, I do think it's going to end up in a trade deal, but we're certainly not there yet. It's a tough battle.
It's funny, Aaron Pacitti, the various presidential administrations going back 20, 30 years have all acknowledged this issue, and now something is being done. In your estimation, and I already know the answer because I hear you every week on the roundtable, is the right thing being done?
I don't think so. I think So I think Trump is right in reexamining a lot of trade agreements and trade relationships with different countries that previous administrations wrote. So I don't begrudge him for that. I think imposing tariffs specifically on China, now that the metal tariffs on Mexico and Canada have been removed, looking at one country and kind of starting a unilateral trade disagreement. I agree with Hugh that it's not an all-out war yet. Is definitely the wrong approach. I think the goals that Trump wants to accomplish could be accomplished in a very different manner domestically, in order that we can better compete with China.
Well, why then did not past presidents do that?
Because then there are hands of big corporate campaign contributors who don't want to see that. A lot of trade agreements are written from a very pro-corporate perspective that really codify investor rights, codify intellectual property rights. So, previous administrations, maybe with the exception of the Obama administration, were very much pro-corporate trade deals. Obama's TPP was kind of designed, even though it had some of those characteristics, to get a multilateral agreement that could kind of contain China and force multiple nations into getting China to do what the U.S. wanted them to do.
Hugh Johnson.
Yeah, the kind of practices that China has exercised for years and years, as you suggested, have been very, very well known. Somebody can ask me sort of bluntly, does or did China cheat? And the answer to that question, when it comes to intellectual property rights or many other practices, the answer to that question is clearly yes. Now, the question is, why didn't we start to play? And when I say that, it's yes. I say that based, first of all, not only on what I read, but I spend some time talking to companies or people that do business with China and have lost a lot of business in China, largely because China has stolen their technology, so to speak, and given it to other companies in China and made it easy for those Chinese companies to compete. And as a result, they've lost market share, almost all of it, and it's all been redirected to Chinese companies. And it's not what I read. It's what I hear, learn, talking to those companies. Robert Lighthizer knows that. Trump knows that. And they won't tolerate it. Now, why in the past hasn't somebody sort of done something about it? And I think that Aaron is basically on the right track. First of all, if you ask yourself, in this particular case, as well as other cases, who is it that's going to be really, really hurt by this so-called trade skirmish? And, Trump would like to say the Chinese are going to pay for it. The Chinese are clearly going to get hurt. Their economy is struggling. But let's not forget that really it's the U.S. companies, which are their cost structure is going to be increased significantly. They may, in many instances, and I think probably most instances, eventually raise prices. And when they raise prices, the American consumer is going to get hurt. So you ask, why hasn't this been done this way before? Aaron suggests there's a better way to do it. There has to be a better way to do it, because in this case, I don't want to say there's no winners, but there probably are no winners. China's going to be hurt. The U.S. economy is going to be hurt. U.S. companies are going to be hurt. And U.S. consumers are going to be hurt. So this is really not good news.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons why, and again, I'll defer to Aaron. It's one of the reasons why I say, look, there's so many that are going to get hurt. Eventually, we're going to get to a deal. as we get closer to 2020 elections, you bet that something will get done.
Aaron, and we'll have to take a break here in a moment. Who can outlast who here?
You know, there's two. These are the world's two largest economies. I think they can go a very long time. I don't think it's a question of who can outlast who, because, you know, China has very direct state subsidies to firms. So, you know, the U.S. tariffs imposed on Chinese imports can be counteracted by, you know, a very well-entrenched Chinese subsidy support for these firms. We're starting to see that in the U.S., although it seems to be kind of ad hoc with farmers and agricultural
right.
firms.
Let's take a quick break here. Our number, if you have a question for Hugh Johnson or Aaron Presidi, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. We talk the world economy today, specifically U.S. and China. Hugh Johnson is here of Hugh Johnson Advisors, Aaron Presidi of Siena College, and you at 800-348-2551. Let's jump on the phones here. Rob in New York. Where are you in New York, Rob?
Yeah, right in the city.
All right, man, you're on.
We love the city. You know, I had heard it from higher authority that the Chinese stock markets are don't function as our stock markets, that they're closed. A lot of foreign investment is not possible, and that a solution to part of the trade a big part of the solution would be the opening of Chinese stock markets. So I was wondering what your guests have to say about that. I was wanted to know if China is still a most favored nation status as it was back in the day. And lastly, I was curious if they knew about what's happening with the economist Pat Choate, who had solutions in his book, The Agents of Influence, and if those solutions that he had back then are still valid.
All right, that's a lot to unpack, Rob. All right, Hugh Johnson first. What about an open Chinese stock market?
He's right that to some extent it isn't open at all. And I don't see the connection as to if you opened that stock market to foreign investors, whether that would help or ameliorate all the problems with regard to trade. So I guess you'd have to sort of explain that to me. I think you're right in pointing out, we're looking at the Chinese stock market, Shanghai Composite particularly. It's very different from our market. That's one thing that's very important. But nevertheless, it does reflect the composite of a number of different investors. They tend to be, and I don't know if this is even relevant, a lot more speculative, and it's much more volatile than our markets. It's almost like a betting arrangement. But nevertheless, they do have their stock market. We do have our stock market. I think what's important are the relevance of the stock markets there and here to what we're discussing is I take the views of investors collectively, not individually, very, very important in trying to decide which way some of these issues are going to go. And I would only say that because if you take a look at the relative performance of the Chinese Shanghai Composite versus the U.S. Composite over the course of the last, say, 6 to 8 months, it's just a slight edge to the Chinese market, believe it or not, suggesting that maybe things are going to be on the mend in China, which is having very big troubles with their economy. So I take it seriously from that point of view, but a connection to this issue is tough for me to understand.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I don't see a link between opening up China's stock markets and resolution of the trade deal. As for most favored nation status or permanent normal trading relations, I believe that is permanent now with China, mm-hmm. in that their goods are allowed to come into the U.S. with minimal or no tariffs, and Trump is simply imposing tariffs, but without getting rid of the most favored nation status.
All right, Rob, thank you for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Hugh Johnson and Aaron Presidi, the guests. And let's go over to Jack in Worthington. Jack, you're on. Oh, Jack, you got to turn the radio down there, buddy. Oh, for Pete's sake. All right, well, all right, that's it. We're done with, I'm sorry, Jack, that's the way it goes. Let's go to Bob in Middletown. Bob, you're on.
Yes. I was just reading a book from the library. It's called The Third Pillar by Rajiv Rajan, and it talks about the three aspects of the world, you know, the government part, the market forces, and the communities like Middletown and New York State and so forth. And it's very intriguing. You know, he talks about establishing a balance between those three factors in society, in the world, really. And I just wonder what your opinion is of that book, if you've read it.
I have not read it, but I know who Rajan is, and he's a very well-respected, very independent economic thinker who comes down on asks very unique questions, comes up with very unique answers. So I can't really comment on the findings of his book because I never read it.
Okay. Well, I would definitely say to the audience that it's a very readable book. You know, I have a basic understanding of the world economic situations. And I thank WAMC for bringing that out to me, especially with BBC and Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. You know, I respect those two sources as well as WAMC.
All right, Bob. Well, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. And our number here is 800-348-2551. And just a reminder, if you're calling in, we love you to call in. Try to listen on the phone when you're on hold. Turn that radio down in advance, and then there's not a lot of noise. My engineer doesn't get upset. Dave in Rock Hill. Dave, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering what leverage we, practically speaking, actually have when we're dealing with, you know, a country that's a fundamentally different political system where citizens say in China can't petition their government the way we can. And if there really, practically speaking, isn't much in the way of leverage, you know, what's the message with that in terms of future trade deals?
That's a great question. I mean, essentially a dictatorship. We have a president who will have to run for re-election. There are political forces at work as well.
Well, this is political is a big, big part of this. And obviously we saw the subsidies today to farmers, and you know how important the farmer vote was and it will be to Trump's
exactly.
re-election. So there's no question that Trump has got a lot of pressure on him, or the Trump administration has a lot of pressure on him. Trump has a lot of pressure on him to do something to get this resolved, hopefully to get it resolved with not simply paying subsidies to farmers that are obviously hurt by it. The Chinese, no matter how you look at it, maybe it's the case that they have don't have a system where it's not a democracy where people can express their views, but there's no question that the Chinese economy, you know, the exports to the U.S. from China, which is about $500 billion per year in goods exports, that's 3.2% of their economy. That may not sound like a lot, but it is a pretty big number. And when their economy is under some pressure, you can bet there's pressure on them to try to get a deal done to try to restore the trade with the U.S. So there's significant pressure on both the U.S. and China, and that's one of the reasons why if people get off their high horse that they're going to resolve this, or I think that a deal will be done as we move closer to the election. I cross my fingers when I say it is very unpredictable. And remember what I said before, Robert Lighthizer.
Right, but
Lighthizer is really tough.
Yeah, and so is.
But they do have. It does seem that they have a much higher squeal point than we do have here, right?
I think so.
In terms of, you know, how they.
Yeah, and this goes back to a previous caller's question about who has leverage over whom. After thinking about that and hearing your question, honestly, I think China has more leverage over the U.S., despite the fact that the U.S. imports more from China than China imports from us.
Yes.
And the reason why
right.
is that, you know, China has, you know, again, a very well-entrenched program of state subsidies to different firms in different industries that's easy to counteract any hardships felt by the tariffs, whereas in the U.S., we don't have that in place. So China can just target specific sectors in Trump-supporting areas like agriculture programs in the, you know, in the South or whatever. So I think China's got more leverage over the U.S. than we do over them.
That's an interesting comment, and I think I agree with it, but for a little bit of a different reason. If we get away from the economics of it, Ray, you are absolutely right. This is about politics, and the reason I think that China has the leverage or has a really strong position is because you know how important getting reelected is to the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So that weight on him, and it weighs on him with the with Canada and Mexico as well. He's trying to get these deals done in order to get reelected. And you're going to see a lot more of this, maybe not related to trade, as we move through the remainder of 2019 and early 2020, a lot.
Yes. So going back to the political nature of this and kind of blending in with the economics, I'm speculating here. Perhaps Trump sees that China has leverage over the U.S. Despite the smaller stakes for China in terms of how much they export to the U.S. That might explain his consistent pressure on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates to give the economy another boost, because he sees that these tariffs can actually be very contractionary for the U.S. That's just speculative.
No, that shouldn't be just speculative. I think,
you think that's the case?
That is speculative, but I think it is the case.
Yeah. It seems to have come at an odd time.
Especially trying to, and I hate to say it this way, but to load up the Federal Reserve with those that'll be very friendly to the Trump administration. I say the Trump administration. I should say Larry Kudlow. They will be very friendly to Larry Kudlow and agree to try to put pressure on other members of the Federal Reserve to choose to reduce short-term interest rates. No question about it.
Yeah, and going back to leverage, this is what I perfectly understand that, knowing Trump's personality, is that he is a, you know, hardball negotiator. He likes to make deals on his own. He likes to take credit for deals on his own. But when you're confronting the second largest economy in the world, going one-on-one is not a good strategy. Trump could have formed a coalition of other countries, the European Union, Japan, Korea, and formed a more coherent strategy that might involve tariffs, might involve some negotiations, but just going, you know, tit for tat with tariffs, I think, is going to be a self-defeating strategy at best for both countries.
Let me add one other point, and that is, it's pretty well recognized, I don't know if it's going to be true, that the U.S. economy is in the process, for secular and cyclical reasons, but is in the process of slowing. It's going to slow in 2019, and it's going to slow even further in 2020. Trump knows that, or at least he's heard that from Larry Kudlow. So he's going to try to do everything that he can to make sure that we don't have too much of a sinking spell. And believe me, there are plenty of economists out there that think we might have a significant sinking spell in 2020. That would be the kiss of death, because one thing he does have going for him now is an economy that seems to be performing well. He knows that might not be the case in 2020, and to have this trade problem hanging over his head and impacting or affecting the U.S. economy is not good news, and that's why he also will try many other things, to include packing the house at the Federal Reserve or whatever he can do to try to stimulate the economy or to help the economy through fiscal stimulus. Watch the fiscal stimulus coming along. We're going to see plenty of discussion about, you know, infrastructure spending. I know that's off the table for the time being. That's
for,
not
for
off the
today.
For today, it's coming back, believe me, and he wants to time it so that it'll have some impact in 2020, although he's getting late on that.
Hugh Johnson is here, Aaron Pasitti as well. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Jason in Catskill. Jason, you're on.
Hi. I hear your discussion. I am really making a comment more than asking a question. My comment is that over the last 50, 60 years, there has been a move toward creating a unitary executive that arrogates powers unto him or herself and vitiates the entire concept of the separation of powers that separates us as a republic from other countries in the world. And the problem is, for example, tariffs are specifically in the Constitution. Levying tariffs is the responsibility of Congress. But because of the national emergency, a matter of national security, which is the excuse through which you can drive a truck, he's allowed to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico, which are certainly not a threat to our national security.
Yeah,
and so I think that's the real constitutional crisis. Trump is a symptom of it and exacerbates it, but in fact, it goes deeper than that and a lot longer than that. That's all I want to say.
Well, national security is clearly one of the reasons why he can impose tariffs, and that's if you look back at steel, the tariffs that were imposed on aluminum and steel, that was one of the reasons, not all of it, but one of the reasons why, one of the reasons that allowed him to impose those tariffs. So you're absolutely right. The president can, for national security purposes, impose tariffs.
There is legitimate national security interest in intellectual property and technology. Correct, Aaron?
Sure. I mean, you could make that argument. In that, you know, they're developed in the U.S. For very specific purposes. That begs into question whether patents should have such a strong role in, you know, economic development. But that's a topic for a whole other day.
Yes, we'll save that one.
But sure, yes.
All right.
I'll agree with that.
Number here is 800-348-2551. What about the treasuries? What about the debt that China owns? Can that be leveraged down the road?
Nope.
Really?
Nope.
Why? Explain.
Here's why. So I hear this a lot in that, you know, China holds $1.2 trillion of U.S. Treasury bills, which represents about 5% of all outstanding U.S. Treasury bills.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the largest holder of U.S. government debt, but a close second is Japan.
Okay.
Who holds, you know, I think like $1.1 trillion. So the argument is that China could dump all $1.1 trillion of Treasury bills, and that would without getting to the mechanics of it, that would raise the cost for U.S. government borrowing, stymieing any infrastructure plan or any other type of fiscal stimulus, which would result in an economic contraction for the U.S. So the standard argument is that China dumps these treasury bills and it throws the U.S. economy into a recession. This is the least effective and almost counterproductive strategy for China. One, it would be destabilizing to the global economy, and it could send, even though it's only 5% of U.S. Treasury bills, the move itself could be a signal of something broader and risk the threat of global contagion. The second point is that U.S. Treasury bills are in such high demand worldwide that getting out of those would force China to diversify into riskier holdings, holdings that are less liquid, and other assets with lower returns. So this is in China's interest to hold these assets. Even if China did dump them in an attempt to raise borrowing costs, global and domestic demand for U.S. Treasury bills are so high that they would probably be all snapped up by other investors in a week. But the main reason you won't see China dump these Treasury bills is that it would have the effect of strengthening China's currency, the yuan, which is exactly what Trump wants.
Okay.
That's the whole point of the tariffs, is to make China import more from the U.S. and the U.S. to import less from China. So if China dumps these treasury bills, they're essentially shooting themselves in the foot is too light a term for the effect this would have. I'm not going to say head, but okay. You can think of somewhere
right
in between.
Hugh Johnson.
I couldn't have said a complex subject more clearly than Aaron said it. Simply stated, the reason China won't do that, or will, if they do any liquidation of U.S. securities, it would be orderly and over time, and it won't be much, is the one place or person or entity that would be hurt the most would be China.
Yeah. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Hugh Johnson is here. Aaron Pasitti. We talk U.S. and China trade. We'll jump back on the phones in a moment. Ordinarily, I would hate to interrupt a bass solo, but I think we have a show to do here. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Aaron Pasitti is here from Siena College. Hugh Johnson of Hugh Johnson Advisors. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call now, 800-348-2551. Kathy in Seward, New York. Kathy, you're on.
Hi. I was a little perplexed by some of the things that you said about the leverage, you know, who had more, us or China, on this thing, and it seemed to me that, you know, you said that China's economy was in trouble. My last, you know, information, you know, maybe it's not up to date, was that their economy's growth had slowed to like 5 or 6%. And ours, if it gets to 3% growth, is, you know, we're lucky. So, first off, I don't think that they're in that much economic trouble. And secondly, you know, they can sell their goods to anybody. You know, they don't have to sell them to the United States of America with its tariffs if you know, that's supposed to punish them somehow. And thirdly, I mean, you know, the tariffs, you know, amount to something similar to sanctions, you know, and he's increased the sanctions on Iran, you know, but they're going to sell their oil to China.
All right, let's go to Hugh Johnson first.
I was just wondering if you gentlemen had any thoughts on those ideas.
Wow. Yeah, you raised a lot of really interesting and important and controversial issues. On the growth of China, it's hard to know what are the accurate numbers, what are the right numbers for China. I hear from very good sources that their growth rate might be around 4%. The official numbers that we're looking at right now are between 6.2% and 6.3%.
Is that official from China?
It's in part from China, but those are the kinds of numbers. If you look at the numbers from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, or the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, you'll see numbers like that. Or if you see any of the sort of surveys of economists as to what they expect on China, and it's roughly around 6.3%. I might add that that's a slight uptick in May from the April numbers. The worry really in China, and the reason that it is something for them to think about, whether it's slowing from 4 or 6.5%, regardless of the numbers you're using, is they know that if there's a significant slowdown, and they're very worried as they do a transition in their economy, if there's a significant slowdown, that raises the potential of some political problems in China. They're deathly afraid of that. Yeah. And so they don't want to see any slowdown when they're making a change. Now, the other thing is they try, like anybody else does. They've got $500 billion in exports to the U.S. They try to sell to other countries around the world. $500 billion is a huge number.
Right.
And they're just not going to find markets for that. We're talking about $100 billion in exports to China. We have found substitutes for that. We have substitutes for that. But $500 billion is a very tough number. So we're talking about $500 billion, the possibility of a slowdown in their economy, which might represent or get them on a pathway towards some political pressure, which would not they're just very much afraid of.
Yeah, I think the 600-pound gorilla in the room that we haven't touched on yet, which I think gets to Kathy's, which touches on some of Kathy's points, is that, you know, since the mid-90s, the U.S. has been running a very strong dollar policy, which means that it makes imports cheaper from other countries and exports more expensive. China's been doing the opposite since they gained permanent normal trading relations, which is running a weak currency strategy where exports are cheap and imports are expensive. If the main concern, which I don't think it is the giant trade deficit between the U.S. and China, thinking about currency realignment would be important, and that's complicated and boring stuff. But there are ways that the U.S. could essentially weaken its dollar to make exports more competitive, if that's what the goal was. But it was kind of the perfect storm of the U.S. being a giant market, U.S. government policy, and to a certain extent Federal Reserve policy of making the dollar strong, made it so that not only could China export a huge amount of goods to the U.S., but it could do so at a very low price to U.S. consumers.
You know, Aaron, for the first time, either yesterday or today, I saw someone bring up the point of, you know, China still has the rare earth card to play.
Yes.
And I think it was yesterday I saw that.
I think to the extent that China has leverage over the U.S., part of that is their holdings of rare earth minerals. I don't know the official term, but
I don't know what you would elements
rare earth elements that are very important in they're very important as raw materials for the building and engineering and construction of
electronics, semiconductors.
So, you know, if they want to play hardball, they could just have an all-out embargo on these rare earth elements to the U.S. because I think a lot of them are contained in Mongolia and different parts of China. They could be found elsewhere, but, you know, that's one of the advantages of having good trade relations with other countries who have strategic products that we want.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. We talk U.S. and China trade with Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasitti. Jay in Greenfield, Mass. Jay, you're on.
Yeah, just a couple quick points. You use the word coherent. I don't think there's anything the Trump administration, that anything they're doing is coherent. And looking at the two sides, China and the U.S., say, like basketball teams, who's got the deeper bench? I mean, Larry Kudlow, I know he plays an economist on television, but is he an economist? I don't think so. You know, the Chinese got a way, way deeper bench, and they got a state-controlled economy. I don't think the U.S. wins in this. That's my point.
All right, well, let's send it to Hugh Johnson first.
I know Larry. He's you're right. He's not a professional economist. I also know some of the other people in the Trump administration. I think your assessment that they don't have a deep bench, or we don't have a deep bench, with the exception of Robert Lighthizer, which I've mentioned many times, I think you're probably right. We could, just as we were just trying to load up the Federal Reserve with some folks that were not particularly qualified, I would say that I mean they're not bad people. They're well educated. They're fine people. They're really knowledgeable people. But you're right. We probably could done a little bit better with our so-called economics team. The Chinese do have a very strong team. I don't think that's the issue, though, to be honest with you. I really think that this really comes down to the strengths and weaknesses which each side has to offer, and I don't think it has a lot to do with the people. I think it's pretty clear what the debate is all about and how it might be resolved.
Yeah, I think the deep bench comment, I mean, I do agree that, you know, China has this very entrenched, very well-oiled machine of state subsidies to strategically important sectors, even forgetting about the technology transfer, just how, you know, a firm's
theft
can get—
Theft or transfer?
I'm sorry?
Theft or transfer are we talking about?
I think it's called tech transfer.
I see.
That's
okay.
Yeah, so let's call it—that's the
gotcha.
Sanitized term. Where was I going with this?
They have a deep bench.
They have a deep bench. They have— you know, institutional structures that support these state subsidies, which the U.S. Doesn't have. But what's interesting is that, you know, instead of getting China to play by U.S. rules, I think the U.S. could learn a lot from adopting some of China's economic policies, namely some of the industrial policies that China has implemented in terms of subsidizing what many people see to be growth industries. I think tariffs are a lose-lose situation for both sides. So if the U.S. had a deeper bench and more variety of voices, you would hear people talking about, you know, subsidies for R&D in high-tech industries like photonics, like quantum computing. You would see subsidies for higher education in the STEM fields, subsidizing firms in these industries. And that's just not a path that the U.S. economy seems to be willing to go down.
Do you need to subsidize when most of the real advances are done on the black budget items anyway?
Well, what do you mean by black budget items?
In other words, all of the real R&D is done way ahead of what we know about.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So, ramp those up.
Well, really? Okay. Let's go to Jack and Latham. We're on. Go.
Hi, guys. Thanks. Very interesting show. Hugh, you spoke to the financial service professionals last November, and one of the things that you sort of indicated was that we're dealing in the business cycle with sort of long in the tooth business cycle, and that normally you don't get a market that goes as long as this one has, and that you could anticipate it easing up at the end of this year or sometime early next year. How is that going to affect what we're dealing with, and how does it affect things on an international basis? Most of the world economy is not piping along the way we are, from what I see.
You're right. Neither the Chinese nor the European market is doing quite as well as we are, although, Jack, we're in the process of slowing, clearly. My view has not changed significantly from the last time we talked. I thought there's a distinct probability or possibility. Again, this cycle is, as you've suggested, in my view, and I think in a lot of other views, long in the tooth. And that presents some significant problems of a slowdown to roughly a 1.9% pace in the U.S. in 2020, if I were to accept the consensus. That puts a lot of, as I mentioned before, a lot of pressure on the Trump administration to avoid what might be called, the end of the cycle, where we have a bear market that's accompanied by an economic recession. So he really has to think about that in this process of negotiating trade deals with anybody, but particularly with China. And that's one of the reasons why, or one of the many reasons why, I would say there's a real possibility we could get this resolved, and probably resolved as we, let's put it this way, approach the election. It's pretty darn important to him. The election means I don't want to say everything, but a lot.
Yeah, I think it was good that the caller brought up the business cycle, because this seems to be a really odd time to start a trade war with China, given the risks to future U.S. growth that you pointed out. Tariffs are contractionary. They raise the prices of imports, whether it's for, direct-to-consumer purchases or for businesses. Ultimately, they end up getting at least partially passed on the consumer, so that raises prices for the consumer, which can slow or actually reduce consumption. But it also raises prices for firms who have these built-in, well-integrated supply contracts or supply chain contracts that they can't get out of. So if you can't get out of them, you just have to accept the higher prices, and you can either raise prices, which can reduce sales, which forces you to lay off workers. The alternative, which runs counter to Trump's let's bring jobs back to the U.S., is that firms that face these tariffs that can't pass on prices and end up laying off a lot of workers might find it cheaper and more efficient for their business to relocate to Mexico. So Trump might be exacerbating the problem he's attempting to solve.
Yeah, and the other thing is, we could talk about lower margins if companies decide to accept the higher prices of the goods that they're importing, particularly raw materials. But if they decide to accept lower margins, and what we've been seeing, of course, is when you watch the earnings numbers, for example, or earnings numbers looking forward to remainder of 2019 and 2020, those earnings estimates are coming down, and they're coming down largely because of concerns about the trade. And that's not good for the stock market, not good for confidence of investors, confidence of consumers, and therefore the U.S. economy. So that's another angle, Jack, which is important to keep in mind when we're taking a look at all the complications here. They know that in Washington, and that's why I think there's some, Trump pays a lot of attention to the stock market, as we now know. But that's why I think there's so much, there's real pressure to get a deal done.
Yeah, Home Depot said that, that the cost of the tariffs and the products they supply were going to already reduce their earnings by like $1 billion this year, and they're looking at another $1 billion next year. Yeah. So these are not small numbers.
All right, let's quickly go over to Bernie in Williamstown. Bernie.
Yes.
You're on there. Go ahead.
Okay. A few minutes back, you talked about if a downturn comes in 2020 or around that time, you said something to the effect that we should probably see the administration looking for a stimulus. And I'm wondering, what kind of a stimulus can you really produce when you just passed a tax bill that set the economy another $1 trillion in debt. Where are you going to get the money to provide a stimulus to up the economy?
You're asking a very, very tough question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure there is any good answer to that question. But you're talking about, and I don't think we'd be talking about lowering taxes as a source of stimulus. And I think you're quite right there. I don't think politically that would work. But we are talking about the possibility of anything to kind of keep this economy doing okay. And that's all he needs to accomplish. And that really gets back to infrastructure spending. Yeah. Yeah. I ask myself the question, did he walk out from the infrastructure discussions with Schumer and Pelosi yesterday because he wants to get the timing right? Now, that's being as cynical as it could
possibly
be. Boy,
I'll tell you, that is cynical, yeah.
That's very cynical, but this they're thinking about it. And and believe me, they're thinking about it. And as you know, we now know that it was fairly well orchestrated. So the point being is that if you're looking for stimulus, it'll be infrastructure spending. What it'll do to the deficits and the debt, just exactly what you're saying. It will increase the deficits. It'll increase debt. And we're getting towards, in my view, this is just me, levels that are, I guess the nice, kind, courteous way to say it is uncomfortable.
But, so I agree with a lot of what you said.
40 seconds.
But the returns to infrastructure spending can have much higher, they can be much higher than the cost of borrowing. So if the U.S. government has to borrow $2 trillion at, you know, 3% to finance an infrastructure project, as long as the growth that that infrastructure project generates in terms of, you know, income growth or, you know, GDP growth, if those exceed 3%, then we'll make our money back over time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think it's a really accurate point. I think they got to get going on it, though, because the payoff's not right away.
Right.
And so good point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, that is where we will have to leave it today. And gentlemen, thank you both for being here. Support comes from the Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, presenting stories in the forest, in the iForest, an immersive storytelling experience in the woods, wildcenter.org for details. River Valley Co-op, Northampton, Massachusetts, a food co-op featuring fresh local foods, a deli department with made-to-order sandwiches, a soup and salad bar, and a bakery, rivervalley.coop. And Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996, imediaconsult.com. Thanks again to Hugh Johnson and Aaron Placidi for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Good calls today. We appreciate them very much. We also appreciate our long-suffering engineer, Zach Malloy. Your calls are answered by Dina Salzman. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, well, you know, it's Friday. Tomorrow is Food Friday. So what do you say we figure out what the heck Belgian cuisine is? We'll do that tomorrow. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.